gene drives rely on gene editing to work. But the whole system of gene drives has to do with how to release DNA into wild populations and have that DNA spread through those wild populations. And this is a project that is actually being funded largely by the U.S. military.
Is that called DARPA?
That is, DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And I recommend that as a acronym to commit to memory. And that what that agency does is it funds projects that are of putative interest to the U.S. military. And this is one of the things that they've been focusing quite heavily on. The idea of a gene drive is that, in principle, you only need to introduce one organism into the environment, and the whole thing spreads, the whole genetic construct spreads through that entire population.
Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth.
Kia ora and welcome. I'm Lisa Eyre, and this is Green Planet FM. Gene editing is the genetic alteration of the natural world. We expose our world to unique hazards with every new technology. Gene editing technologies are becoming one of the most discussed issues of our day. They are the stage after genetic engineering, and the media are attempting to tell us that it is safe and could be done in your garage at home. Really? Whatever the size of a change made inside a cell, and some scientists like to say they're very small changes, I don't see how they can tell us that messing with DNA is a safe thing to do when we increasingly realize that the planet is an integrated living system. Organisms are self-organizing complex systems, and so I'd like to know how it can possibly be safe to manipulate and mess with our food and animals. Today, I have on the phone Dr. Jonathan Latham, who is a prominent international advocate for public interest science. He is co-founder and executive director of Bio Resource Project and the editor of Independent Science News and director of The Poison Papers. He is currently in New Zealand on a speaking tour. Dr. Latham holds a master's degree in crop genetics and a PhD in plant virology. He worked at the Department of Genetics in the University of Wisconsin, Madison, USA. He has published scientific papers in disciplines as diverse as plant ecology, plant virology, toxicology, genetics, and genetic engineering. Welcome, Jonathan.
So, hi, Lisa.
It's really good to have you in New Zealand. Thank you for coming.
Now, oh, you're quite welcome. I'm having a good learning experience here.
And you're actually English, although you've been in the States, obviously, working there.
I've been in the States 11 years. Yeah, we started our non-profit 11 years ago. But we used to do GMO work and scientific critiques, actually for probably 6 years before that.
Right. Oh, well, you haven't picked up the accent. Just if I'm talking about you having been in working in America, you don't sound like that. So,
just, not so much.
No, just clarifying. First of all, people are going to say, what's this gene editing? How is it different from genetic engineering?
You know, there are several differences between that and genetic engineering, but the gap is also not as wide as the kind of rhetoric of the media and the scientific community would imply, really. There is, one of the things that happens with gene editing is that this is alteration of DNA made, for the most part, inside of cells. So classical GMOs were basically you extract DNA, you cut it up, you stick it back together again, and then you you insert that DNA, you throw that DNA back into the plant or the animal, which are whatever you intend to engineer, and so that DNA has been kind of manufactured, if you like, outside of the plant. Whereas gene editing, what you're doing is you're introducing enzymes into the cell to change that DNA. And so one of the implications is that you're introducing enzymes and you don't really know what they will do, for example, and what kind of effect they will have on the genome of the plant.
Right. So when we're not really sure of what they do to the plant, and if the plant is planted outside, of course, there's a danger of those getting into the environment.
Well, that is part of the possible things that can go wrong. The intention, the stated intention, at least, of the people who intend to make these crops is that the enzymes and the bits that do the cutting and the guiding of the cutting process in the cells will not end up in the final product. But this ends up becoming one of the big questions, because in order to do, especially for crop plants like corn and maize, and tomatoes, for example, you need to, in order to do this cutting process, you need to get the DNA that codes for the protein and the RNA and the editing equipment into the cell in the first place, and that has to enter into the genome. And so it becomes a breeding task to identify the bits that you think you've cut, the bits that have been, you know, cut in error and that you don't want anymore, and separate those from the actual part of the genome and that you want to be in the food supply, but also to separate that from the editing apparatus that you put in there because you added some DNA. So you've got a whole mix of things that will end up going on in these cells, which all have to be separated from each other in order to produce a crop that is safe.
So it's definitely playing God.
I don't think that messing with DNA is necessarily playing God, but what it is doing is messing with things that we don't understand too well, and that are inherently going to be unpredictable. You know, what I was saying in the talk that you were at was that organisms are self-organizing complex systems. They are not just kind of machines built with DNA and you can swap in and out parts. Because they're complex systems, changes are not necessarily predictable. That's part of the definition of a complex system. So, you know, no matter how hard you try in predicting, and no matter how many times you've put this gene into a different plant or the same plant or a related plant or a very similar gene, you can't actually know what the consequence will be.
Okay, so it's going to have to be a very long-term project before they can actually put these things out into the food we eat.
Well, yes, because essentially to attempt to make sure that these things are safe, you will have to do a lot of testing. And that means testing of the actual thing that you want to bring to the market and not merely of its component parts. So one of the stories that's being spread around gene editing is that this is a very easy thing that you can do in your basement or you can do in your flat at home. And that is not my belief at all. This is a kind of a trope made to obscure the fact that actually this is going to be a technology controlled and owned and leased by companies like Monsanto and Dow. They will be the big players and they will be doing the work. But there's a whole story, which I would say is deliberately being spread by some kind of PR group that we don't need to guess who's behind them. But the point about this trope is that it kind of implies the little people will be doing it and small startup companies will be doing it, and that's not likely to be the end game of this gene editing business.
And there's a lot of money being put into gene editing, isn't there?
There's a lot of money, a lot of government money being put into it, also corporate money. And then there's a whole separate thing which is called gene drives. And these gene drives rely on gene editing to work, But the whole system of gene drives has to do with how to release DNA into wild populations and have that DNA spread through those wild populations. And this is a project that is actually being funded largely by the U.S. military.
Is that called DARPA?
DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And I recommend that as a acronym to commit to memory. And that what that agency does is it funds projects that are of putative interest to the U.S. military. And this is one of the things that they've been focusing quite heavily on.
Well, that relates to New Zealand because I read an article that said that they were interested in doing experiments to get rid of rodents on New Zealand islands. And I thought, why on earth would the US military be interested in getting rid of rodents in New Zealand? There must be something else behind what they're doing with that sort of gene drive.
Yes, the U.S. military is not interested in nature conservation, that's for sure. There's several things going on there. First of all, you know, think it will actually, you know, at any point anybody releases one of these things, it will be an experiment. But at the same time, you know, the stated intention of this is to get rid of these rats or these mice or, you know, there's various projects envisaged in various places. And these projects are not—they're not really experiments. They are actually attempts to alter conservation outcomes or to create solve public health problems. At least, you know, that is their kind of overt, superficial goal. But as you know, as you can imagine, the fact that this is being funded by the U.S. military means that the conservation part of it is a kind of a facade, if you like. It's a front for them being able to do more kind of fundamental projects that they envisage will be, you know, potentially useful in military situations. And it's pretty horrendous to consider it. But, for example, the DARPA has a project called Underwater Allies that they are basically, their idea is to genetically engineer and put these gene drives into organisms that live under the sea and make them agents of the U.S. military. So there's no limit to the amount of imagination and potential disastrous outcomes that could arise from all this.
It sounds absolutely horrendous, to be honest. I'd hate them to sort of use dolphins as their spies or something. Yes, so, but mosquitoes have been manipulated, haven't they? What's the word I should use?
There is genetically altered, probably, is a reasonable description of this. I mean, there is a number of mosquito projects out there. You know, some of them are not genetic in nature. They involve infecting the mosquitoes with a bacterium that alters their reproduction so that it harms the species at the population level.
That sounds so, like the one that's being used in Townsville in Australia.
Well, that, I don't know the specifics of that project. There is, so the ones that are not genetic in nature, that's a bacterium called Wolbachia. Then there are also projects to irradiate mosquitoes, and those the released mosquitoes are not fertile. There are also projects to gene edit mosquitoes to alter the population. And then there are also these gene drive projects. And the most, you know, the scariest one of all is these gene drives, because the idea of a gene drive is that, in principle, you only need to introduce one organism into the environment, and the whole thing spreads, the whole genetic construct spreads through that entire population. So that is the scary thing about that particular one, is that that is actually intended to overtake the population and change it or send it extinct in some way. So that's what this Underwater Allies is about.
Okay, and of course if that then mutates to another species, that's really serious too. For example, you know, the mosquitoes, if they make the mosquitoes sterile, that way, they could then make other insects sterile and we could lose our pollinators, for example.
Well, the you know, it's not clear how much these genetic entities will be able to spread to other species. You know, the worst case scenario is that they work in the mosquitoes, and then the mosquito mates with other species of mosquito and drives those extinct. And then that makes those, but those mosquitoes, you know, they may mate with other mosquitoes as well. So you can kind of sort of envisage a chain reaction, but at some level it will stop. But what you could end up doing is driving quite a few species extinct. And there are potential uses of gene drives in, for example, organisms like plants and grasses and other species where the gene pool is potentially wider for that kind of thing to happen. I mean, what, you know, this is what risk assessment and regulation is supposed to look into and decide, but it's not at all clear where the risk assessors and regulators are ever likely to do a good job with these kind of technologies, because the set of questions that need to be answered are very, very large, and we don't really have the answers to them, in part because these are wild species that we're talking about. If you make a GMO and you release that into the environment, this will be a corn plant or a canola. At least it is a species that we actually know quite a lot about, its life cycle and its history and its variants and its pests and its pathogens and so on and so forth. Whereas, you know, when you come to mosquitoes and rats and other species like ticks and all the kind of subjects that have been talked about in the scientific literature and the media as potential targets for all this, many of them are species that we know very little about.
Well, and I guess every species is here for a reason, even if we don't know what it is.
Well, it's here because it has a near biological niche, and if you empty biological niches, stuff happens in ecosystems. Yeah, that's exactly right.
And they'll be filled by other things.
Oh, yeah, potentially worse things. You know, that's part of the interesting question. You know, it's like dropping 1080 or whatever, and you kill the possums, and then you find that you're overrun with rats or whatever. This is the kind of stuff that happens because people are not even looking at these things. The level of the ecosystem itself is my you know, in interpretation of what's going on. There's very, very little interest in doing that because, you know, the wider you cast your net of possible outcomes, the less likely you are to ever want to do this. So there's a pressure from inside the system, you know, inside of academia, where there's lots of people chomping at the bit to do this and funders chomping at the bit to give them money, that the wider you know, and the wider or more appropriately, I would say, that you draw your risk assessment dragnet, the less likely you are to want to do it.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned 1080 because it's a huge issue in New Zealand right now, as you've probably noticed as you travel around.
It's been mentioned a bunch of times, and I have no theoretical really understanding of the issues, but I can maybe field the question, but I'm not sure I'm the right person to answer it.
Well, just the logic of pouring poison all over the country seems a little bit odd. I mean, you actually wrote or were involved with the poison papers. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so this is changing tack quite a bit. So these are documents obtained from the Environmental Protection Agency in the U.S. and from chemical companies as well, like Matt Dow and Monsanto, that kind of reveal many of the internal machinations of these organizations. So their memos and meeting minutes and internal reports and letters between them that reveal, really incredibly extensive collusion and collaboration between them and to the detriment of the public. And it concerns things like dioxins, things like pesticides, things like PCBs. So there's a very wide range of chemicals that are implicated in these papers.
And glyphosate?
Yeah.
And so there's, I mean, there's much discussion this week about glyphosate and its safety, and whether Roundup is less safe than glyphosate.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm reluctant to talk about individual chemicals, you know, in the context of the poison papers, and I'll explain why that is, if you don't mind.
No.
Because, you know, what these poison papers show is that if you ban one chemical and you focus on one chemical and you know, raise a concern and it gets removed from the market, what happens is that the public gets focused in on the toxicity of individual chemicals, and the chemical industry is normally quite happy because they can substitute another product. You know, they'll substitute 2,4-D or atrazine or cinazine for glyphosate, and they will be happy to allow councils to use that when that compound may even be more dangerous than the glyphosate that was substituted. And the basic, you know, the basic issue of the poison papers is that the whole regulatory system is corrupt, that there are fraudulent and falsified and faulty approvals that are knowingly being accepted by the regulators, and those regulators are then finding, you know, even when there's evidence of harm. So if you remove most of the evidence of cancer and most of the evidence of chronic toxicity and you do the studies in a fraudulent way, it's still sometimes perfectly evident that this is the product that harms people. But when they find that information, the regulators basically ignore it. So they find ways to ignore the data. So when I worry when people talk about individual chemicals, because the whole system is completely rotten. You know, it's unscientific, it's unethical, it's corrupt, it's completely broken. And so, you know, anybody who uses a chemical in their home or around their, you know, on themselves or in their cosmetic products and so forth, you basically do that at your own risk, because the system is so broken that you will not be getting any protection from the companies who make them, or the regulators who oversee them, or the independent testing companies whose job it is to be independent of the chemical industry and do, you know, tests independent of those and of the EPA, do honest tests, basically. So you know, it's much more important that people focus on this big picture than worries about single individual chemicals, because inside you'll have hundreds of different chemicals. Glyphosate will only be one of them. And so you should be worrying about those, you know, the other 299.
Right. That's very logical and makes sense. And, of course, the whole story is about money, isn't it? And is that why you're the editor of Independent Science News?
I am the editor of Independent Science News, that's right. And what we do is we try to find, you know, academics and people who can write about the big stories that they're involved in, which the rest of the media won't touch because they are, you know, these stories are too important or too incriminating of science or the scientific process, or incriminating of regulators or of companies who are doing bad stuff in and around toxic chemicals and GMOs and sewage sludge and these gene drives and so on and so forth. So that is what we do. So if you don't mind, I would encourage your readers to subscribe to our website. You won't receive very many emails, but this is a really important place to get information to understand the extent of contamination of the natural world and what, you know, and ideas about what can be done about that.
And that's independentnews.com, isn't it?
Independentsciencenews.com.
Independentsciencenews.org. .org, not .com.
Yep, definitely
okay.
.org.
Okay, independentsciencenews.org. But I just Googled Independent Science News last night and it came up. And I was interested in an article on there about the Clinton Foundation. Oh, no, have I got the wrong one? Hang on.
The Gates Foundation.
The Gates Foundation, yes.
Yeah. The Gates Foundation has its finger in a lot of pies, yep.
Can you tell us about that?
Well, the latest one we did was the was their undermining, attempt to undermine a moratorium that the United Nations was going to put or considering putting around gene drives. So the idea was that none of these gene drives would be, done in open experiments or be able to be released. And what the Gates Foundation did was, along with DARPA and the various European governments, officials, and also a foundation run out of the National Institutes of Health, they basically organized scientists to undermine this moratorium in discussion groups. So they employed a PR company, and they got these scientists to all kind of say the same thing, and they sent them emails, and somebody contributed to the discussion group so they could weigh in, and basically they succeeded in swaying the discussion around this project simply by being very organized and very well funded.
Right. So, the level of corruption, and as you were mentioning earlier, the media is implicit in this, is terrible, really, for us to find out what's okay, what's safe.
You will virtually never find out any useful information about these things in the media. Yep, that's correct.
So, who's owning the media that's doing this?
The media is... firstly, it's owned by, people like Murdoch and I'm not very good on media control. But anyway, they're big companies, and they're linked in with lots of other big companies. And the point is that, the backstop for journalists is that if they're going to cover any interesting subject in the media, their backs are not covered. Do you know what I mean? They're out on their own. And they're likely to lose their jobs and their positions if they uncover something that's at all interesting. And so they would spend their entire lives poking around in places that are not interesting, like the Kardashians or, sunscreens and cancer runs and things like that. Because as soon as you start to ask questions, it's exactly the same in science. As soon as you start independently to answer questions and follow threads of, seemingly fraudulent or mysterious activities, you end up in some bad place about corruption of politics or corruption of the scientific establishment or corruption of the political process. And no one wants you to go there because their shareholders and their friends and their contacts and the PR companies who are all tied in with them all have an angle that they're working, and you will end up upsetting that. And so we take pride in our independence, and it's the only way, really, that readers can be guaranteed of hearing anything that even remotely resembles sense.
And your website is independentsciencenews.org.
That's the one, yep.
And I'm Lisa Eyre, and this is Green Planet FM, and I'm interviewing Dr. Jonathan Latham on gene editing and the poison papers, and I now want to move to CRISPR, which is clustered regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats.
Yep.
Which is a form of gene editing, isn't it?
It is. I mean, we can rehash a little bit the discussion of gene editing at this point, but it is basically a way of changing DNA inside of cells, but it has kind of ramifications for the rest of the organism, for example, if you actually try to do that. Yeah. So it is a technology that is part of gene editing, is what CRISPR is. Yeah.
Because that's the one we hear about the most. On Saturday night, you spoke about three other sorts, didn't you?
There are others. There's one, for example, called meganucleases. There's one called zinc finger nucleases. There's another one called transcription activator-like effector nucleases. But I think, people don't need to worry about those too much, except to understand that gene editing is a family of technologies. It's not merely one thing. But it is true that CRISPR-Cas9 is the version that makes people most interested. It's the most flexible and easiest to do And you can edit multiple sites in the genome at the same time and so on, so forth. It has a bunch of advantages over the others that mean that it's being highly fought over at the moment.
And there again, we're talking about government and corporations funding to do all of these things. And is that because they're going to try and do things like golden rice with vitamin A and things?
They may try to. I mean, you know, the Gates Foundation is the latest organization to throw $50 million at golden rice. And, you know, that's a project that's been going for 25 years. Has had at least, you know, minimally $100 million spent on it, but probably closer to $200 million. And they don't actually have a project yet. And, you know, I don't think they could do any better with gene editing than they could with conventional biotechnology. It's not, you know, their understanding of the organism is too insignificant to be able to actually make this product. And what they found is that they've made a rice. The rice yields are significantly less than the normal rice because you're basically diverting biochemicals and activities from one pathway to another. And lo and behold, it turns out the plant needs the pathway that you diverted stuff from, so it doesn't work too well. And then what they also are finding is that the vitamin A in it biodegrades. And the reason why it biodegrades is because rice, when you dry rice, it's exposed to oxygen. And the oxygen degrades the beta-carotene. So within 2 weeks of harvest, there's basically nothing left. And whereas, you know, if you get your vitamin A from a carrot or a spinach, that is a living organism that's full of water, and the oxygen is mopped up by other molecules. So this degradation does not happen at nearly the same rate in carrots and spinach and other places that people, you know, which are the places people ought to be getting vitamin A from.
Right. And the other thing that worries me, of course, is how does the gut respond to these genetically engineered or gene-edited foods?
Yeah. Well, the way that it responds to you know, conventional GMO food is probably the most interesting question at this point, because, you know, since the advent of GMO crops, we've had an epidemic of gut complaints among the population about gluten intolerance and inflammation, all of which are things that are linked to malfunctions of the gut and the intestine.
Well, so I can give you an example. I was going to say I can give you an example in myself, because of being dairy intolerant, I started drinking soy milk, and then I became gluten intolerant.
Okay, that's interesting. Do you know if the soy milk that you were drinking had any GMOs in, or was it organic?
It wasn't organic in those days. I was a little less knowledgeable about it all way back then. It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And so, no, it wouldn't have been.
Yeah. So this is a, you know, quite a classic story, I would say. And, you know, I was in Queensland 3 weeks ago giving a talk about the insecticides that companies put into GMO corn and soybeans and some other crops. And, you know, at that time, Lisa, there probably would not have been any of these proteins in soybeans. There might be now, but there wouldn't have been at the time. But the point about these proteins is that what their mode of action is to make holes in membranes. And what they do is they make holes in the membranes of the insect's stomach, and then the stomach basically disintegrates and the animal is eaten from the inside by the contents of its gut. And what the question for regulators then is, if people eat the exact same crop, whether that will also happen to them. And the answer, the jury is still out, as to whether that will happen. Whereas the regulators and the companies have convinced themselves that there's no problem. And the companies are telling regulators that the proteins they're putting in are just natural and harmless, and there's nothing interesting going on. And what we believe is that there is no real reason why these proteins, protein toxins, the way they shouldn't also make holes in human gut. But But the definitive proof is kind of lacking because the regulators don't actually want to ask the question or test it. But there is data. There's a woman I was co-presenting with a couple of weeks ago after the Rockhampton conference, and she was explaining how her research of feeding GMO corn to pigs and to rats showed evidence of gut inflammation resulting from that feeding. And this is gut inflammation that, you know, is separating gut cells from each other and basically, you know, ruining, you know, either inflaming the gut or ruining its integrity. And then, and so the gut becomes red, it becomes inflamed, and some of the animals become sick. And what she is concerned about is that it is these toxins that are doing that, causing that inflammation. So there are big and important questions out there that the regulatory system is failing to address.
Well, I understood that our DNA was not so different from a fruit fly. So that would kind of make it rather logical that if you put an insecticidal protein into our food...
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, that we are pretty different from a fruit fly. And our DNA, you know, it's a question of definition. You know, you can argue that our many of our genes have counterparts in a fruit fly and so forth. But, you know, their organization and the precise nature of those genes is really quite different to fruit flies. So there is, you know, you can argue it both ways. You know, compared with a bacterium, we're pretty much first cousins with a fruit fly. But compared with a, you know, a rabbit or a chimpanzee, we're very distantly related from a fruit fly. So you can take your pick.
True, but then if there is some evidence of the insecticides inflaming people's stomachs, then I guess we have to think, well, maybe that's where we need to go back to. I'm not a scientist, so I'm just guessing.
Right. The fruit fly argument may be the most appropriate under those circumstances. Yeah.
That's right. Now, to do the gene editing process, do you have to create a GMO first?
Well, not necessarily. If you do it in a for an animal, for example, or if you do it in a bacterium, what you should be able to do is inject the editing apparatus, the protein that cuts the DNA, and whichever molecule you're choosing to find the right place in the genome to do it. So in principle, it's not necessary It's not necessary to introduce DNA. And DNA is what, you know, foreign DNA is what more or less defines being a GMO. So if what we're editing is the embryo of a cow, for example, or the embryo of a sheep, you can do it without making a GMO in the sense that you've not introduced any foreign DNA. Now, the European Union has already decided, at least at the Supreme Court level, that all these gene editing technologies are GMOs, and they will have to go through the regulatory process that GMOs entail. And so they have defined them legally as GMOs. Where it becomes interesting is that when you try to do this whole technology with a plant, in the case of a plant, you can't, to do the gene editing, you can't just introduce a protein and introduce an RNA. You have to introduce DNA. And then in order to introduce the DNA, you have to shoot it in with pellets or infect it in with a bacterium. And then that creates genetic damage, that creates tissue culture, that requires tissue culture, that introduces thousands of other mutations. You also, that DNA that you introduce will have to be inserted into the genome. And so then at that point, you have a GMO. And the job of the company and the regulator will be to make sure that the DNA that you've added, which codes for the CRISPR RNA and the Cas9 protein, is removed from those of the eventual product. But, of course, there's no guarantee that they will be able to do that because it can be hard to spot them, or they may be lazy, or it takes a lot of genetic work to do that.
So for me, as a non-scientist, when I look at sort of pictures of how GMOs are done, they're sort of like a picture of a gun firing something into a cell.
That's right.
But when I go on Google Images and look for a picture of gene editing, I get pictures of DNA with knives or scissors cutting out.
Yeah, they you know, this is public relations for you, that they show, you know, a nice, neat picture, and they call it editing, which is, implies copy editing, implies tweaking. It implies tiny little changes, whereas what I've just told you is that you're shooting in particles with DNA, that there'll be complex things that go on in the genome, that there will be introduced all kinds of interesting other pieces of DNA, and so what's going to end up is quite a biological mess in all probability. And the history of GMOs is that many GMOs have been made that have yield problems or agronomic problems, or that have altered biochemical concentrations of important things, or that failed to take up mineral nutrients from the soil, for example. So that means that you know, the history of GMOs is not a reassuring one when it comes to safety and so forth. And so there's no reason why the history of, or the future, if there is one, of gene editing will be any better. It may well be much worse.
So it's a very political thing, really, as to whether to allow these things out, you know, expose the environment or expose humans and animals to these products. So it's like the whole politics of food, really, comes into question as to who owns the patents.
Well, I can already tell you who owns the patents. Mostly it's Dow and Monsanto and Syngenta on these crops and the new gene editing products. There's the whole point of genetic modification. The first iteration of it was to take control of the seed supply, because, you know, through a quirk of our patenting, you know, no doubt a deliberate quirk, but a quirk of our patenting system, if you own the DNA that of a transgene and you put that into a crop, then you own the whole seed that you've put that into. So you may have added one gene or two, three genes or whatever it is. Or, you know, in the case of modern GMOs, there's often about 10 genes in there. But if you add, in principle, one gene, you own that whole crop, even though this crop has 50,000 other genes in it already. So what that means is that people who do GMO technology are an enormous advantage in the marketplace. They can not only own the property rights in ways that weren't previously possible, but they can also, because you can identify these transgenes in the crop very easily, they have the means to enforce their copyright, their intellectual property, rather, which is, you know, half of the battle, right? You don't want to have to go to court and be there for weeks and weeks arguing that this is your apple and not someone else's. You just show the judge this piece of paper that shows the DNA test that you did, and it's done and dusted, and the test can be done in half an hour. So there's no arguments around that. But that was the basic point of the original version of GMOs. Nobody in the business community really was that interested in the traits. They mostly wanted to be able to consolidate the seed supply. But then the other part of it is that the people who did this consolidation was the chemical industry, because then they can have farmers sign up to use only their chemicals and only their products and basically make the farmers beholden to them. So that was the big kind of business game plan. But you're right, this comes down to politics, because what they've been doing is introducing legislation to stop people and independent saving seeds and being able to sell seeds, breed new varieties, so on and so forth. It's become very difficult for anybody else to operate in this space. And this is the control of food, the control of land, the control of people's ability to feed themselves is the deepest level of politics imaginable.
So it's intellectual property rights. And then, of course, particularly in the US, you have the court cases. So in New Zealand, I feel that we would be the ideal country to be completely GE-free and free of gene editing and all of those things, because we have a lot of sea around the edge of us, and products can't spread. Whereas if, for example, you're in a European country and you try to be GE-free, you can easily be contaminated by seeds blowing over the fence, the border.
Yeah, I mean, in order for that to work too well, you have to imagine that you're not importing too many products. You know, New Zealand is continuously importing products, agricultural products and products by accident and so forth, to then spread around. But you're right that it is easier for New Zealand to avoid these things than, for example, you know, Belgium or Germany or something, and there's a whole bunch of examples of GMOs spreading from one country to another one, unwanted and unbidden. And I no doubt that process will continue because, you know, quite a few agricultural seed materials escape from the field and become feral or semi-feral.
And there again, if the world is an integrated living system, which I suspect it is, it messes everything, doesn't it?
Well, it will. I mean, firstly, it messes with your exports. I mean, secondly, you know, these feral crops are problematic. You know, often they're problematic in that people are already spraying glyphosate, for example, on their, you know, in their banks and whatever. And if GMOs that are resistant to glyphosate spread around, then they can no longer be eradicated with glyphosate. So depending on how much you like glyphosate, this becomes a problem. And it seems like councils around the world have been convinced that glyphosate is a relatively safe compound. And so they're using it a lot, and that's sometimes how GMO contamination becomes apparent. So you have all these complicated systems, but I agree with you that, you know, it's at our deep peril that we mess with all these genetic systems of the natural world. It is a deeply problematic thing for me because you can't know what's going to happen next when you do it.
Well, it is. It's too big an issue, isn't it? Too many variables for us at this stage. I mean, you know, maybe in 100 years they'll know a little bit more about what the causations and all of that. But at the moment, if you start feeding people or animals, to be really sure what the results are, because, of course, with animals in a field, they then defecate on the grass, don't they? And then that affects perhaps the whole carbon system.
Things pass through animals, that's right, and become taken up by, you know, whatever you eat will be taken up by your gut bacteria, you know, whether it's DNA or chemicals and so forth. So the ramifications become interesting. And what's, you know, sort of different about DNA is it becomes incorporated into living organisms and then can spread, you know, a bit like antibiotic-resistant bacteria. They start off living in the wild somewhere, and then they move to farms where animals are being spread a lot of given a lot of antibiotics, and then they move into the guts of farmers who are, you know, on their farms all the time. And then from the farmers, they get into the hospital system when the farmer goes to hospital with maybe pesticide poisoning or cancer or whatever, and then they get into the rest of the population who passes through the hospital. So you have all these chains of events that happen with DNA that, you know, for the most part don't happen with other chemicals.
That sounds absolutely horrendous, doesn't it, really?
Mm-hmm.
the implications of all of that.
Potentially that's exactly right, yeah.
So the other... what would you call it? The other project that I've noticed that you are involved in is you're a co-founder and executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, that is more the umbrella organization. So we have a publication, which is the Independent Science News. Then we have the Poison Papers website. So that's poisonpapers.org. So that's a way of accessing all these papers if people are so interested, or just reading about the media coverage of those papers. So, but the project itself, what we do is we do independent analysis of scientific questions that people are basically steering around or steering past because it's pretty obvious that if you go into these things, the only likely the result is going to be some kind of embarrassment for the regulators and agribusiness and the companies who are making these GMO products, for example. But we try to, you know, do a deep analysis of, for example, the insecticidal proteins that companies are putting into plants, or the viral genes that companies are putting into plants, or the nature of the genetic engineering process, for example, to try to get to the bottom of all the risk questions that people ask but never have good answers to. And so there is they're having all these problems with people don't understand what is going on, and so we have to we try to help out with that, because we're trying to, you know, scientists don't want to go there, and so the only people who will go there is us, because we're independent of all of that. So we can actually do that. But these papers, you know, are often 5-year projects to get something, to research something, to understand it, to publish it, and then to share it, often more than 5 years, in fact. So these are big and kind of deep projects. But they're available on our website for people. Summaries, but also some people may have a deeper scientific need, you know, if they're regulators or you know, NGO people and so forth.
So the website for the Bioscience Resource Project is?
It is bioscienceresource.org.
Right. Okay. So there's actually some really interesting things on those websites. I was dipping into them last night, the Bioscience one and the Independent Science News and the Poison Papers. So you've been very busy. Do you actually now, these days, are you doing scientific experiments yourself?
No, we don't do any wet lab research. All of it is, talking at events, or it's reading the scientific literature. You know, when we do these kind of deep dives into the science, it's better if it's not complicated by some of the data being ours. Do you know what I mean? Because we can refer to data and people can agree or disagree with the conclusions, but at least, you know, this is working off of other people's experiments.
And you don't really have an objection to GE and gene editing in a laboratory, as long as it's not intended to go out into the environment?
The problem with I don't have an objection in principle, except that people are trying to use these as vehicles to grab intellectual property and so forth. But what I do have is problems with gene drives even in the lab, because what those gene drives the one way to think about them is that if they work, then it's not if they work, then they're incredibly scary, and if they don't work, they're a complete waste of time. So which one of those do you want to be your outcome? The outcome you want is neither of those, and therefore there's not really any point in doing experiments to kind of figure that stuff out.
And let me just get this straight. Gene drives is where you're manipulating the cells of animals.
No, gene drives is where you are basically introducing genetic constructs that spread in a population. So it requires gene editing to do gene drives, but you're trying to make a genetic construct that basically perpetuates itself through the generations. So normally, if you put a piece of DNA into a mosquito, that mosquito becomes a GMO mosquito, but the mosquito strain that you have added this piece of DNA to is likely to go extinct. It's likely to be lost in the population. it will not be selected for, and so it will disappear. And the whole idea of a gene drive is that then once you put this piece of DNA into that mosquito, you only have to introduce one mosquito. Its children all bear that particular piece of DNA, and its grandchildren all bear that piece of DNA. Even though it's mated with other mosquitoes with a different genotype, their genotypes are lost, and your gene drive genotype is preserved in the population. So the idea is it will spread. So the idea is that you introduce one mouse or one rat onto an island off the coast of New Zealand, and that is enough to drive that whole population extinct because the gene spreads and the gene is bad for the reproduction of the animal, and so the population goes extinct. But then you have the problem of what happens when that mosquito or that mouse spreads to the mainland and then spreads to Europe and other places where it's not wanted. So you have a technology that is incredibly powerful. If it works as it's supposed to work, it's incredibly powerful. And so we don't, we think it's too dangerous to use.
I think I totally agree with you. It sounds horrendous. They've released GE mosquitoes already in various places, haven't they? And I'm thinking,
yes,
well...
but they're not gene-drive mosquitoes.
Okay. They're just modified, are they?
Yeah. People have to come and watch my talk online to understand the difference between gene drives and gene editing. But gene drives require gene editing. But you have to create a construct that incorporates a gene editing apparatus, but also it has a way of harming or changing the genes of the organism that you put it into to create the trait that you want. So it's a much more sophisticated and complex version of a gene editing event.
And oh horrors, because that's what the U.S. military are looking at now.
The U.S. military wants to do it, yeah. They're already trying hard.
Yeah, and that makes me feel very unsafe for the human population in the future. Jonathan, it's been really good talking to you. You've got so much incredible detailed knowledge, and it's great to talk to a scientist about these things that isn't part of the system that the financial system, the intellectual property, and the Monsanto gravy train.
There aren't enough of us. Yeah. You have Jack Heineman here in New Zealand who is also fits that mold.
We do. He's excellent. But just getting the government to listen is another question.
Indeed. Yep.
So I'd better let you go now, and thank you so much for talking to me on the phone. And I wish you all the best with with your trip back to the States, and keep up the good work.
Yeah, well, share your interviews, and thanks very much for giving me the chance to be interviewed.
Oh, that's quite all right. Thanks again.
Thank you for tuning into this Green Planet radio show. I trust you have derived both enjoyment and insight as we empower ourselves with a greater understanding of the magnificent, multifaceted world that we inhabit. In these coming times of rapid change, it's going to take raw courage and inner resolve. And so I thank you as we all remain both focused yet relaxed as we challenge the status quo and let go of the old as we energetically co-create the new paradigm. Because I can assure you, every one of you are important now. When you go to bed tonight, ready for well-earned rest and sleep, realize that what you think, feel, and do is part of your unfolding destiny. And when we commit to a higher act of goodwill and or community service, Providence also lines up. So that every conversation we have, every email we send, every phone call we make, and every meeting we attend, that we stand in our power and communicate intelligently, warmly, with integrity, knowing that we are actively shaping a collective future that will benefit all our children and grandchildren, as well as that of a larger community. This is Tim Lynch in Auckland from Nuclear Free New Zealand, and mobilizing unity consciousness wishing you a stupendous week of heartfelt success. I say bye-bye and hari rā.